Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration will come to order. A quorum is present. The first item on the agenda is approval of the minutes for Friday, July 1st, 2022. Is there a motion to approve those minutes?
Motion to approve the minutes.
Representative McBadgey moves approval of the minutes for Friday, July 1st, 2022. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. The next item on the agenda is a presentation on the safety, accessibility, infrastructure needs, and security of the state office building. Members, thank you for joining us today. It's not usual that we have Rules Committee hearings after the month of Advent and Hanukkah have started, but we are needing to address serious concerns and problems in the physical structure that we have here in Minnesota for the public, for our members of our House staff or House members, for members of staff who work in the Legislative Coordinating Commission, the Reviser of Statutes, the Secretary of State's office, and other public officials who are essential for conducting the business of state government in Minnesota. And we are going to hear today a presentation from nonpartisan former House staff, our Sergeant-at-Arms, Representative Meyerson. Bob, you're such a presence in the state House of Representatives that we would like you to be one, but you, I guess, probably don't want that for yourself. And I should note, before Mr. Meyerson commences his presentation, that he was originally selected as the House Sergeant-at-Arms by Speaker Daudt in a move to professionalize the security apparatus of the House of Representatives, recognizing the need to adjust our practices in the House and to make ourselves as safe as possible under increasingly difficult conditions. And we have had an opportunity to recognize Mr. Meyerson on the floor of the House for his service. We had a reception in his honor. But I'd just like to state again today, thank you, Mr. Meyerson, for our increased safety, for professionalizing the operation of the Sergeant-at-Arms office, and for leaving the House of Representatives a better place because of your service.
Thank you very much.
Please proceed with your testimony.
Chair Winkler, members of the House Rules Committee, for the record, my name is Bob Meyerson, Robert Meyerson, and I'm a former Sergeant of Arms for the House. I had that privilege to have that role and act as Chief Sergeant for 8 years. And I think I prefer that over Representative Meyerson. So today I'm going to talk about some of the vulnerabilities and issues that exist here in the state office building. And my perspective that I'm going to share with you today comes from not only my time as a Chief Sergeant of Arms, but also as a state trooper. I was a trooper for 29 years, and many times throughout my career I had the occasion to come to the state office building in the Capitol Complex, either to respond as a special response team member or to do training. And it was, I believe, in the mid-90s of the first time I actually came into the state office building, and I participated in training in this building. I didn't know anything about what happened in the SOB before that, and I learned a lot. I learned that the building by intent is very open and accessible to the public. That was with pure intent, and it's also has some security challenges, this building. And I think that was the first time I became aware of the conflicting mandates that exist in this building. We're required to, and we want to have this open, both in perception and reality to the public so that they come in and participate and observe the legislative process. But we also have a mandate to provide a secure and safe and functional building and accessible for all. And I have learned increasingly over time that we have challenges in those regards in meeting those mandates. And part of it is because of the building and the structure that we try to work in. In 2015, I was elected as a Sergeant of Arms, and the Office of Sergeant of Arms is more than just security. It serves to create and to maintain a functional workspace for members and staff and the public to come and do this important work. And I work in collaboration with the Department of Administration, Facilities Management, as well as the Department of Public Safety, the State Patrol, and other entities. And joining me today, we'll have some other testifiers, as you can see on the agenda, that will assist us in giving kind of a comprehensive picture of the realities of what the building is. But I have concluded, as I've spent a lot of time here, that the current condition of the Minnesota State Office Building creates vulnerabilities and increasingly threaten the House's ability to protect the occupants. Now, the public, staff, and members, and their participation in the democratic process. Before we go on, I think it's kind of important that you have an understanding about the history of the State Office Building and what the original intent was. The building was created and built. There was a need back in the early 1930s, and 31 and 32, the building was constructed, and the intent of the building was to house, it was a state office building. It housed offices in this building. It wasn't intended for legislative purposes. We didn't have large crowds that came here to participate. The picture that you see in your handouts and on the screen, that is of the agriculture holiday protest. And I think that was the extent of the public crowds that would come to the state office building at that time in the 30s. The functions didn't include the legislature or the House of Representatives at that time. Things evolve in the state, and in the early 70s, there was a constitutional amendment that was put before the people, and it was decided that our legislature would meet on an annual basis rather than every other year. And there was an increasing need for the legislature and the members of the House of Representatives to have offices. And it was in 1974, that was the first time that members of the House of Representatives had offices in on the Capitol complex. Prior to that, your office, had you been a member then, would have been your desk on the House floor, and that would have been the extent of the office space that you had. So in 1974, members of the House were given offices in the state office building, and they asked some other commissions or other entities to leave to accommodate the needs of the House. The following 10 years, I think it was recognized that the building really didn't accommodate the needs of the House at that time. There were committee meetings, and there were large groups gathering, and it was in 1984 that there was a major reconstruction of the building. Everyone was displaced into swing space. I've heard a lot of stories about that, and it was a reconstruction project renovation that I understand was done relatively cheaply, and it was done quickly, and it exceeded deadline. I saw a couple documents that memorialized the events surrounding that renovation, and I noted that there was a number of concerns that were expressed by members at the time and soon thereafter, and many of the things that we're experiencing and dealing with today. The condition of the offices, the hearing rooms, because of the fluctuating humidity levels, the paneling in these rooms, in our committee rooms, have a tendency to bow and buckle depending on what the humidity levels are in the room. There's extreme challenges when it comes to maintaining consistent temperature levels within the rooms, in offices, in other meeting spaces as well. But what happened is they increased the meeting space, and the picture that you can see on the screen and in your handouts depicts prior to the 1984 renovation, and we had open wells, light wells, and courtyards in the center on either side of the elevator banks. They enclosed those and allowed us to have more space for hearing rooms as well as office space in the building. Let's move to 2022, where we find ourselves today. All members of the House of Representatives are in the state office building and offices. We have over 230 staff. That's both partisan and nonpartisan staff that works in his office out of this building, as well as staff and officials from the Secretary of State's office, the Legislative Coordinating Commission, the Revisor's Office, Legislative Reference Library, and the Legislative Budgeting Office, and the Capitol Barber, which is located in the basement of the building. This building currently has 10 hearing rooms, for medium size. This is considered a medium size hearing room, and we have six or smaller hearing rooms. The seating capacity ranges from 50 to 200, and it's very common that we exceed the capacity in our hearings. It doesn't have to be a major or controversial hearing anymore. There's an increased appetite for being present in the state office building and in these hearings. It's unusual, I think, that we have hearings with as few people as we have. And as we come back from the pandemic business model, I think that we're going to see the numbers increase again. So we do have some major concerns in the state office building. It doesn't meet the current local and state building codes, standards, workplace needs, and public access and accommodations. This is an outdated infrastructure. Mr. Given is going to be talking specifically about some of the challenges and a very objective assessment of the infrastructure and the condition and the trajectory of where we're going with the infrastructure. We have safety hazards embedded throughout this building that have resulted in very concerning injuries, and we've been lucky they haven't been more severe and impactful for the people that have been injured because of the condition and the existence of this building and the work that we conduct in the building. We also have barriers to access to the public services and facilities for people with disabilities. And our friend from the Minnesota Council on Disabilities, David Finley, will also be addressing and talking specifically about some of those challenges. And we have inadequate space for visitors, public participation, and staff. We're putting people in locations that weren't intended for human occupancy, and the challenges that come along with that are clearly evident. I think you'll gain an appreciation for that if you don't already have it by the conclusion of this presentation. And we also have some life and safety and security issues within the building that are ongoing. It kind of boils down to three areas: our infrastructure, our functionality, and our safety and security. We have challenges that the building isn't currently meeting. And for those of us that are responsible for providing a safe, secure, and functional and accessible environment, we have these insurmountable challenges that we face on an ongoing basis. With that, I would ask that Mr. Given gives a presentation from his perspective from the Department of Administration Facilities Management Division.
Well, thank you, Mr. Morrison.
Mr. Given, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Christopher Given.
Christopher
Given, and I am the Director of Facilities Management.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As I mentioned, I am the Director of Facilities Management, and we manage and operate the facilities that the Department of Administration manages. Our team operates over 23 buildings, 19 of which are here on the Capitol complex. We're a team of 269. We're composed of trades consisting of plumbers, electricians, carpenters, machinists, maintenance engineers, painters, locksmiths, refrigeration mechanics, project managers, and professional support staff. We're also groundskeepers and mail handlers because we provide those functions as well on the Capitol complex. I've been in my position 11 years. I'm a registered professional engineer in the state of Minnesota. I'm also a retired Air Force officer where I spent my career operating and maintaining and evaluating Air Force facilities throughout the United States and around the world. Since 2010, one of my top priorities has been to renovate the state office building. Today, I'll try to substantiate empirically, from a facilities management perspective, the need to renovate the state office building. Next slide, Bob. Okay, got it. So today we'll take a look at what a facility assessment is. We'll go over briefly the results of the most recent facility assessment that was conducted on the state office building, and then I'll briefly discuss some of the challenges that we in facilities management face on a day-to-day basis. Next slide, please. So what is an FCA? Well, it's a standardized approach that the state uses to assess its facilities and rate them in a certain condition. It's rule-based. And it looks at several different components within a building: foundation systems, the slab, the building structure itself, the envelope, the windows, doors, interior windows, doors, walls, ceilings, interior finishes, the HVAC system, electrical system, the plumbing system, elevators, and any other systems that might be in the building that are related directly to the facility itself. And when we say rule-based, well, what do we mean by rule-based? Well, it means that all agencies in the state, and we all have adapted this methodology for assessing our facility, use the same rules. We use the same calculations when we decide what condition our facilities are in, and the same methodology to calculate the end result of a facility condition assessment. We also use the same scoring technique, which is really important. It takes the subjectivity out of evaluating facilities. And then we apply the same ratings to each of the things that we see out there. Facility assessments, they're based on a standardized cost model that was developed by RS Means. So if there's anybody in the room that's from the engineering or architecture community, you'll know what RS Means means. They're probably the largest database supplier of cost estimates for construction. They're used nationwide. As a young college kid, that's what I started estimating construction projects with. They're historically based. They're updated every year by the cost engineers at RS Means. They've got over 92,000 line items for construction. So they've got cost estimating tools and techniques for just about every type of facility that's out there. We also utilize the best practices when we conduct these facility condition assessments. And those are obtained through classroom training of our assessors and field training. So our assessors, when they're deemed to become an assessor, usually they're somebody from a facility management entity within the agencies, will be chosen to go to training. They receive 3 days of classroom training conducted by facility condition professionals that we bring in from the industry to teach these individuals who have architecture and engineering backgrounds already how to make decisions when they're assessing and looking at the building. And then from there, they go out into, they utilize a lot of the buildings on the Capitol complex as kind of a training lab because we're kind of centrally located. But also some of the agencies that have facilities within the metro area bring them into their facilities too so they can learn how to conduct these facilities. So it's really a stringent process that is well-defined across the agencies of the enterprise in the state of Minnesota. The FCA process, and I'd really like to stress this, is intended to minimize subjectivity when we're looking at our buildings. Next slide, please. So how do we conduct this? And I'm going to try to keep this simple because there's all kinds of fancy equations that we use when we do this. And I don't want to bore you all with the details, but it boils down to just a couple of key things here. Okay, so these assessors who have been trained, again, they do have architecture or engineering backgrounds, go out and they look at different systems within a building, as I mentioned in the previous slide, all of those different systems. And they assign that subsystem or system within a building a condition code for between 1 and 5. 1 is the worst, 5 is the best. And then the rating is plugged into this fairly long equation that has all kinds of things that have been rolled into it. It's an algorithm, as we say in the scientific and engineering world, that has been built to give an end result, okay, based on a lot of historical data that's put into it. So it has included in the algorithm maintenance backlog, how much of the stuff we have of a certain system that we're looking at, because it varies depending on what you're looking at. Its condition that the assessor makes a decision on, the age, and then the replacement value of that specific system as defined by RS Means. All right? So from that algorithm, we get a facility condition index, FCI. And a lot of people interchange them, FCA, FCI, two different things. FCA is the process. The FCI is the index or the result of the process that we get from that. And that's what pops out of the algorithm. The FCA provides an excellent means for maintenance prioritization. So you're doing an assessment on all of the systems within the building, and so you can determine which one has the most need or is in the worst condition. And then for those of us that have building portfolios of several buildings, we can prioritize which buildings need to be worked on first. So it's really handy. And this model is used by the federal government, other state governments other than Minnesota, as well as local governments. So it's a well-known model that we're using out there. Now, the last facility assessment that was done on the state office building was the summer of 2020. We cycle them every 3 years because of the number of buildings that we have. So we're due to do another one here this summer on the state office building. And you can go to the next slide, Bob. So this is kind of the output of that algorithm I mentioned about. And so it comes out with a rating. An FCI, or facility condition range, or the index, ranges from 0 to 1.0. So a 0 would be like, and lower is better in the FCI world. 0 would be like a brand new building. And a 1 would be something that needs to be torn down tomorrow. It's just there's no life left into it. Our goal in facilities management across the enterprise is to try to have our buildings in the good range, which is between 0.05 and 0.15, the green. And that's what our goal is, and certainly not all of our buildings are there. But once you start getting into those lower ratings, the yellows and the orange and, of course, the red and the higher FCI rating, you know, the buildings start to require a lot more renewal if you're going to keep them operational, and that's what we try to avoid. Next slide. So now I just want to highlight some of the systems on this building, of the ones that we talked about, that are troublesome for us and are cause for concern. So I've got, I think, 10 of them here that we'll just look at. So the first thing are the slab and the basement walls. You can see from these pictures, we've got leakage in our foundation walls. On the far left picture, you can see where facilities management, we've kind of jerry-rigged a catch basin. That's a plastic bag hanging on the wall, catching the water and throwing it into a trash can so that it doesn't leak all over the floor. You can see some seepage in the middle picture coming right through the CMU, the concrete masonry units. And then just some floor cracking that we see throughout the facility, especially in the basement levels. Again, not caused necessarily to tear the building down, but certainly we need significant patchwork and repairs on that part of the building. Next slide, please. Windows, and you all are probably well aware of this, but many of our windows, the thermal breaks are no longer good, and so we get a lot of cold air that comes through those. You get condensation that forms on the windows. We have some windows that are leaking, and you can see the staining that has occurred on that brass or aluminum. Pardon me, it's aluminum window from leakage and condensation. We've got lintels that are rusting that need significant, rust removal and repainting. In the far right picture, you can see, it's hard to see in this picture, but if you look in the lower right corner in the shade of that window frame, that's mold that's showing up on the wall there. And that's from condensation that had occurred, probably throughout the winter on days like this where these windows aren't sealing. So they need replacing. Next slide, Bob. Same type of thing on the doors. Again, the doors worked well when they were new, but they don't insulate very well at all. And so you get a lot of condensation on those doors, a lot of air coming through those doors, and it's really troublesome from us, not only from the staining that it creates on the doors. You can see the staining that's actually on the terrazzo there on the floor in that left picture. And then on the right, we've got, it's difficult to determine what this is, but that's a joint. Near a roll-up door, and the joint has failed, and there's a lot of air that gets in there, and it's just time to replace. Next slide. The roof. The roof's in pretty tough shape in two facets. First of all, the tiles. It's been up there 40 years or more. We've got nails that are popping out. We've got loose tiles. Some of the concrete mortar that's used to embed some of the tiles has really started to deteriorate just because of normal weathering here in Minnesota, hail and freeze-thaw. What's hidden there are the rain leaders. Those are the gutters, for lack of a better term. And on this building, as on all of our buildings on the Capitol complex, the gutters go down in through the walls. And a lot of those pipes are leaking. They freeze up in the wintertime. We've had problems in recent years where the walls are soaking wet on the exterior of the building because water froze up in the rain leader when we had some warm weather and it rained, and then it's thawing out and it's leaking all over somebody's office. So those rain leaders, and that's hugely expensive, are going to have to be replaced, and they come down in through all the walls all around the building. Tiles need to be replaced as well. The roof structure, however, is good. Don't have to touch that. Next slide, please. Interior, you all see this every day. You know, the ceilings are getting old. They're stained. They're grimy. We've got some cracks that need to be repaired. It's just time to update it. Next slide, Bob. Plumbing systems. Again, it's old. A lot of them have buildup inside of them because of the time that they've been here. And even more critical now as we try to advance and become more sustainable as an entity here on the Capitol complex, the slope of the pipes that are in the building now do not accommodate low-flow water fixtures. You know, when you use a low-flow toilet, you're using a fraction of the water that you used on a regular 5 gallon per flush toilet. And with less water, there's less liquid to move the waste through the lines, and so it stalls and it builds up. The most critical thing for us in facilities management is the system in this building doesn't have any intermittent valving through it. So if we have to do a repair in a bathroom on one of the floors, we've got to shut the whole building down water-wise for domestic water. And that's really troublesome for you all and for us. And so in a new building or a renovated building, we'll have valves on every floor where you can valve one floor off while you're doing water work on that floor. So that's really a big thing and a big problem, very problematic for us. Next slide, please. HVAC system. And this has been kind of the root of a lot of the things that you'll see a little bit later in this presentation, but it's old. And it's antiquated. Back in the day, it's a pneumatic system, all right? So that means that all of these thermostats that you see around the room, they're controlled or they send their direction to the control unit down in the basement somewhere by air. And sometimes you'll hear a hiss from the thermostats. It's an old pneumatic system. It was good in its day, but it's very, very difficult for us to control temperatures with that kind of system. They're inefficient. And they're just antiquated compared to today's digital systems that you'll see in renovated or new buildings. The piping of the HVAC system has failed in the past, and it's going to fail again, I guarantee it. I can't tell you which day or which minute, but it's going to happen again. And you can just see, some of the joints are old and leaking, some of the valves are leaking. There's high probability of risk with this system. Next slide, please. Electrical system, nothing more than the fact that it's just outdated and it can't keep up with the plug loads that we have today. Realizing that a lot of our technology equipment is much more energy efficient, there's just so much more of it. And so the loads that come out of those plugs when everybody's here is more than this system really can handle. And we've jerry-rigged this building over the years to make it work. It's code compliant, but it's jerry-rigged. It's not the way it should be. Next slide, please. Interior finishes. You see this every day. They're 40 years old. It's just time to update. Next slide. And then finally, in the fair to poor range, is our fire alarm system. We just replaced the main panel a couple of years ago, but the rest of the infrastructure is 40 years old, and it's really getting hard for us to get parts for that because that system is outdated. Next slide. So I talked about the components of the building that were fair or worse. This is a roll-up of everything we looked at in the last facility assessment. So you're going to see some green in there. You know, there are some things that are rated good or better. So that means that we don't have to level the building. I mean, there's still a lot of things that, are good about this building. It's, and so therefore it warrants keeping. But because of the number of the fair or poor, the scope of the fair or poor, how much of it there is, and the cost of it, it brings the overall rating of this building to a very low fair, all right, just barely over poor. And I suspect that in July, when we do the next facility assessment, it'll be in the poor range because we do these every 3 years, so we'll be due in July. So I'm not going to bet on it, but I suspect that it will be in the poor range. So let's go to the next slide. The last slide that I have here today is just some of the challenges it presents us in facilities management. And kind of a little comparison here, too, as well, for you all. So it's evident by what Bob has said and kind of what I've gone through today that, you know, holistic repairs have been put off for a long time. I got here back in 2011. I was a project manager just before that up in real estate. And one of my projects was the pre-design on the restoration of this building back then. And so we've been at this for quite a while now. These things have been put off, and our problems have gotten worse and worse over the years. So you can see in that first bullet there, or that first heading on the slide, that, you know, this is pre-COVID because it has been quieter during the COVID years because not as much use has been put on the building. But there has been, and there still is, a continual need for service on the building. You can see over 1,000 service calls that we've made and 2,800 work hours. And that's quite a bit. And by comparison, under there, I compared it to the Minnesota Senate building, which is 6 years old now, about the same size. It's a little bit bigger. But you can see we spend well over 2.5 more times in this building than we have to spend in that building because of just the nature of the repairs. And over 1.5, 1.6 times as much time in here and about that much more cost in this building. And we're dealing with plumbing leaks. We're dealing with, you know, the HVAC, cooling, heating, and cooling adjustments to help make people comfortable. Because the more comfortable, my philosophy as a facility manager is, the more comfortable the people are in the buildings, the more work they get done. And we're failing you guys on that right now, I guarantee it. Plumbing fixtures, again, always got some breaks here and there. And then the electrical system. So we would really love to have some kind of a holistic repair, revitalization, restoration, whatever you want to call it, on this building as soon as we can get it. Because this continued Band-Aid approach isn't going to work. It's not going to hold up. And it's just a matter of time before there's going to be a leak and, you know, we're all going to be standing ankle deep in water again, I guarantee you. So from a practitioner's perspective, and that's what I am, you know, we really recommend renovating this building. So I'm going to wrap up this morning, and I'm going to say what a facility condition assessment does not do. Okay, it does not account for the security deficiencies within the building. It doesn't account for ADA deficiencies within the building. It doesn't account for the functional deficiencies within the building, how you all operate. And it doesn't account for the occupant disruptions or inconvenience. It does not tell me that. It just tells me what needs to be replaced and when. So I'm going to toss it back to Bob or Mr. Meyerson so that he can continue and Captain Roski and Mr. Finley can talk about some of those other things that the FCA does not cover.
And members, I'd just like to have them finish their whole presentation. They're going to stick around. You may have all of your answers or questions answered by the time we get done. If we can hold on questions, but I know everybody's going to stick around and be ready for that. So, Mr. Meyerson?
Sure.
Chair Winkler, members, thank you. I appreciate Mr. Given and his presentation and also his efforts. We work together on an ongoing basis, and I know that he has done what he can with the given resources to make sure that this building remains operational and functional, but I also know firsthand the struggles and the challenges that he and his department deal with. So we kind of looked at this objective assessment from the infrastructure of the infrastructure, and I would like to speak a little bit about the challenges, the end results, some of the things that we deal with here because of the age of the building and the declining infrastructure and the major mechanical, electrical, and structural deficiencies that we deal with. We have flooding and moisture intrusion. As you'll see, that's kind of an understatement. We have inadequate ventilation throughout the building, high humidity in offices and assembly areas and the storage spaces. And we have the extreme fluctuations of temperatures. In June of 2016, I was called in the early morning hours sometime around 6:30, and I was told by dispatch, the State Patrol Capital Security Dispatch, that there was a leak in the state office building and that I probably should come in and take a look at it. And I did so, and as I arrived on some of the lower floors, I noticed that there was a lot of water. Someone had put a sign up caution, wet floor. And I went up a couple floors, and I saw there was a maintenance person with a shop vac trying to suck up some water. And I finally made my way, trying to find the source of the leak, to the fourth floor on the east side. And I encountered this. This wasn't merely a water leak. This was a major flooding that was occurring on the east side of the fourth floor. And this was as a result of a failure in the plumbing system, the aged plumbing system in the state office building. We were lucky this day. We are lucky that this didn't occur during the legislative session, perhaps even luckier that it didn't happen during the legislative session on a committee deadline week, because this wouldn't have been merely an inconvenience for us and for you and for the public. This would have profoundly impacted the state's ability to conduct legislative business, this important work. We are lucky that we didn't have the water infiltrate and go into the wiring closets. This picture is of the data center located in this building where the revisor's office has their data center, as well as the House of Representatives.
Where is that?
I would prefer not to say specifically where. I'm sorry. Suffice it to say, it's located in this building, and we are very fortunate because it literally came within inches of hitting this, and it would have destroyed water and electronics. I'm told, I'm not a professional in that area, but I'm told that water and electronics is a bad mix. And we came literally within inches. We have wiring closets that go from the top floors down to the bottoms, and this water was in those closets. We were lucky that day that we had professionals that came in immediately, and they covered with sheets of plastic. But it could have been just literally inches, and if they hadn't got to it in time, we would have been shut down for the foreseeable future. The information that's on those data centers and those banks is irreplaceable. This was the result. After we got the water shut off, this was the reality in the hallways and the offices. Picture, if you would, that this occurred during the legislative session, and there's original bills, green jackets, and other documents on the desks, let alone people's personal property. This was on the whole east side of the building, and it required substantial work to mitigate and to repair this. They came in and they shut off the east side of the building starting on the fourth floor, and we had to preclude people from going in there, and we took down walls minimally. We took off the bottom couple feet, and what happened more often than not throughout the building, as you can see, we had to take the walls down. We went down to the studs. That wasn't the first nor the last. Prior to that, in 2016, we had a relatively small flood, you may require that, not flood, a water leak, and we were fortunate that we had people present at that time. And this is not uncommon. We have water leaks. These are just a couple of them that we pulled out and documented in March of 16. Then when later in that year, we had the flood that we saw. And January of 2017, we had a significant flooding. And that is in the area, the tunnel area that goes to, from the state office building to the Capitol. That impacted the area where our budget and accounting office is, off to the west, and also where we store items to the east of where that picture is. An ongoing perpetual problem that we had with water intrusion because of the age of the building is in our photo lab on the ground floor. Something else to note about that is we have people officed in our photo lab in an area that wasn't designed originally for human occupancy, but because of the need, we have people there. We had flooding that occurred every time we would have heavy rains or quick snow melts, and as a result, they would be displaced. We would have the challenge of the humidity levels impacting the equipment and the furnishings down there and mold growth.
Mr. Meyerson, before you move on, a member of this committee is referenced in your slides and would like to make a comment.
I just wanted to point out for the committee, that did happen in the corner, and I appreciate your help in fixing this problem, but I just wanted to point out that was at a time when I was still working out, and I was able to actually hold Mr. Meyerson off the ground with one hand in the photo.
So. Representative Dowd, that is actually a superhero.
Yeah.
Sergeant-at-Arms. A superhero Sergeant-at-Arms who was hovering there. Mr. Meyerson, please proceed.
Chair Winkler, members, that is quite a picture.
So is this.
This picture that you see now, this was in an area where my office was at one time located, and this is the reality of the environment where we're placing people. After being out of the office for literally just a couple days, came back and we found on a wicker basket this mold growing. And this is due to the condition of this office building and the need to place people in areas where we don't have adequate environmental controls. We have insufficient ventilation in hearing rooms for audience capacities. You've probably all experienced it when these rooms are full. We have an inability to cool these rooms down, and it gets heated in more than one way in this room when we have a lot of people in the building. A modern building should be able to accommodate the people that want to come in here and also be able to accommodate the temperature and humidities in the rooms. This is a single-zone building. And what that means is there's no compartmentalization of the smoke or other contaminants. So you'll notice sometimes someone will be cooking something in the building, perhaps popcorn, and it burns. And if it happens on one end of the building, it's throughout. If, say, someone burns a burrito on one of the upper floors of the building, you smell that throughout the building. And the downside of that further, more than just an inconvenience of an awful smell, is we have an inability, if there is actually a contaminant in the air, we don't have the ability to compartmentalize that so that contaminant would be throughout the building. The exhaust and fumes are drawn in from exterior ground intake levels. I don't know if you've experienced that, but oftentimes in this room we've had the smell from the right outside in the loading dock when we have diesels, vehicles that are making a delivery. We'll have an odor come in from that area. And we have poor control of extreme temperature fluctuations. The temperature fluctuations is an ongoing challenge, and we have a couple examples of that that we'll talk about in a little bit. But that is an ongoing and challenging situation. During the summer, it's too hot and sometimes too cold because we're trying to accommodate the air conditioning in one area that adversely affects the heat or the temperature in a room right next door. It's an ongoing challenge. We have safety hazards throughout this building. Now, when Mr. Given referenced the furnishings of the building, it seems like it's kind of a benign, innocuous thing. But it's more than just the aesthetics of the building. This picture that we have, the first picture that you see on the left on your handouts and on the screen, this is one of our hearing rooms where we have the rail that goes around between the audience and the member tables. Well, on one particular day, we had a crowded room, and we had one of our staff lean up, rub past this, and ended up being embedded with about an 8-inch piece of wood. And if you see on that picture, that wasn't a small piece of wood. It went in the back of the leg and out the front of the leg. We were lucky that the injuries weren't greater. That person was taken to the emergency room, and there was a subsequent major operation to remove that. It wasn't a matter of just taking a tweezers and pulling it out. It was a major operation to remove that. We're fortunate. We're lucky that it didn't hit an artery or a nerve, or there wasn't a substantial follow-up injury to deal with after that. The next picture that you see on there is in the north stairwell on the lower level of the stairwell. We have no elevators in our parking ramp, and we have no causeways for people to walk across from, other than the lower level where you all park, to walk across from the parking ramp into the building. We oftentimes have people coming in either with mobility issues or carrying objects, and they are taking the staircase in lieu of going outside in the elements or going outside where we have some challenging situations because of some of the activities that are happening outside. We encourage people to come into the lower level and take the causeway, the link, into the state office building. But in this instance, someone was walking down, and it's my understanding they were walking down, they had their hands full, and they hit the bottom step, didn't realize there was one more, and they planted themselves in this window. They broke this window. It's a reinforced window, and they broke with their body and their head, and they were injured as a result. But we were lucky. We were lucky that day that the injury wasn't more severe, but it was definitely a workers' comp claim that was involved with that. The picture on the right is the vehicular ramps, the ramps that are designed for vehicular traffic, and we have signs up. You hardly can see it, but there is a sign between the two ramps that indicate that people aren't supposed to walk up and down that. This is Minnesota. Days similar to this, that ramp becomes slick. If you've driven up and down it, some of you may have slid down that in your vehicle. And people, because of what I've mentioned, we don't have an elevator. We don't have a causeway to go across, and we've created a very dangerous situation. We've had people fall and injured, and Kelly Knight can attest to the worker comp claims that have been filed as a result of that. The challenges associated with access to this building for able-bodied people exist. And I would like to have David Finley from the Minnesota Council on Disability to talk more specifically about some of the challenges that we have here in this building as it exists in its current state.
Mr. Finley or Fenley?
Fenley.
Mr. Fenley, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is David Fenley, F-E-N. I know most folks out there have F-I-N, but I'm F-E-N-L-E-Y. So David Fenley, I am the Americans with Disabilities Act director, or the ADA director, at the Minnesota Council on Disability. We are a state agency, a small state agency, essentially assigned with supporting the civil rights of folks with disabilities. And part of the civil rights of folks with disabilities are technical standards that exist both in the ADA and in our state building code. And as Mr. Meyerson has alluded to here, just in the last few slides, anytime you increase access for folks with disabilities, you're essentially doing it for everybody. So an elevator in the parking ramp would be good for folks with disabilities, but it would also be good for everybody else, delivery folks, staff, representatives, anybody visiting the state office building. So I'll say it again, but any accessible feature that you install in a building or the built environment will benefit everybody in society, not just folks with disabilities. It's really important to note that. In the following few slides, you'll see the downfalls of having less accessible spaces, routes, and entrances in this building. We'll focus on three aspects of accessibility. So visual access, that would be for folks who are blind or have vision loss. Hearing access, that would be for folks who have hearing loss or are deaf. Fun fact, about 20% of folks in this country and state experience hearing loss. That could be, you know, minor hearing loss or just being fully deaf. So it's not a small percentage of folks who would benefit from hearing access. And one kind of fun technology that is not technically in the ADA or in building code that can increase access for folks with hearing loss in rooms like this, essentially what it is you would pull the carpet up, you'd put in what is a very thin metal antenna, and that would take everything that's said in the mics and it would project that into somebody's hearing aids or their cochlear implants. It's an amazing technology, but it would be an example of how someone could go above and beyond the ADA. I say that because we view the ADA as the floor, the baseline. Building code is where you start from, not where you end at. It's if someone says, oh, yeah, we're going to be ADA accessible, I say congratulations, you're obeying the law. It really is where you start from, and you go above and beyond from there. So when looking at accessibility, start with the ADA, but then look at other features you can to increase accessibility for folks with disabilities. So another fun fact, 1 in 4 Americans, that includes Minnesotans, does have a disability as defined by the ADA. Whether or not they self-identify as an individual with a disability doesn't matter. If you have a disability as defined by the ADA, you are covered. I myself have a disability. You can't see it. It's non-apparent. The majority of disabilities are non-apparent. Could be cancer, could be depression, could be you use a wheelchair because you had an accident or you were born with a disability. Another fun thing is that every single person at some point in their lives will have a disability. Whether you're born with it or whether it's right at the end of life, you will have a disability. So this is not for other people, you know, those people over there. It is really for every single person. Next slide, please. All right, so as we see here, it just happens to be that this is this room. You know, we have what would be considered a piecemeal approach here, a retrofit, an afterthought. The ramps behind me are nowhere near meet the technical guidelines, both in the ADA and building code. And those technical guidelines were instituted in 1990. So as we see here, this ramp was installed after the fact because the slope on those aisles cannot support an individual who might be using a wheelchair, who might be using a scooter, a walker, canes, or just someone with limited mobility who can't navigate the slope of that. What Bob just did was raise and lower it. Imagine, you know, you came to this room, you know, you use a wheelchair, you need to get down to this level. You might even be a representative. Say the hearing is already happening. You know, do you want to be the person who essentially maybe interrupts the entire committee? You know, everybody's looking at you. Oh my gosh! You know, that's not dignified at all. That's not equal access. That is a piecemeal approach to access, and it's really just one example of how access should be incorporated into design, not put on top of it afterwards. Next slide, please. All right, so here we have an example of what is the only accessible entrance currently in this building. It's the same entrance that is used. It's the same entrance that is used by delivery folks. The same entrance that is used by emergency responders. It's the fire lane. It's where dumpsters are put. So, again, we have a multi-use space here that folks with disabilities are using as well. Any time that this space is taken up, it would be considered a barrier to access. There's liability in that. You could technically be sued every time there's a barrier to access. I don't want lawsuits to happen. I want accessibility to be built in on the front end. So one of the only ways that folks with disabilities have to enforce their rights is to complain or sue. We're not big fans of that because it really draws attention to us. We tend to like to advocate on the front end. Again, build accessibility into things from the beginning so you don't have to worry about doing it afterwards or potentially facing litigation. And access really does respect the dignity of every Minnesotan. You know, this is the people's house. Taxpayers, voters, everybody deserves to have access to this building. Next slide, please. All right, so hearing room capacity. It's not, you know, quite often these rooms get full. They're small. You know, you're doing important work here. People have the right to be here and to observe what they're elected leaders are doing. This is an example of an extremely full room. People are sitting in the aisleways. I'm sure we would all look at this and say, oh, wow, that's a safety hazard. You know, what if there was an emergency? How are you going to get out of this? How are you going to get out of this room in any, you know, quick fashion? And imagine now if you have limited mobility. People are not going to be able to go up and down these access aisles if they use a scooter, if they use a wheelchair, and even for representatives who might have limited mobility. I know we have some, and I know we're going to have more, because as we get older, these vessels we inhabit on this planet break down over time. So it's inevitable. that representatives and members of the public will need access to this space. I can't imagine operating a scooter to get maybe to the chair's position right now. Even in this room right here, it would be very disruptive to everybody. The clearances, while maybe they fit into the technical standards, it's technically accessible, it's not as usable. Again, going above and beyond building code, going above and beyond the ADA is the most important thing. We can also think about staff who might have disabilities. So this really is for the benefit of everybody. So in conclusion, the ADA states that there's an ongoing obligation to remove barriers. That means that there are no loopholes. There's no grandfather provision in the ADA. That's a lot of people think that, oh, my building was built before 1990. I don't have to do anything. That's not true. We don't care if your building was built in 1890 or 1990. There is an obligation, especially with government. Government actually has an increased obligation under Title II of the ADA as opposed to businesses that fall under Title III. Businesses have a lower obligation to have access. You could probably guess why. Government is taxpayer-funded. Government needs to be accessible. As you have listened to my testimony, the status of the SOB, the building we're in, really does leave a lot to be desired. And I can say point blank, folks with disabilities are being denied access under its current condition. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Fenley. Mr. Meyerson?
Chair Winkler and members, appreciate David being present with us today and talk about the condition from the perspective of the advocates for those with disabilities. One of the slides that he showed here is the hearing room. This next slide, this depicts what is now commonplace. I think that one profound change that has happened over the time that I've been here is there's been just this increased appetite for people to be present, and it's not for the controversial hearings. It's an interest to be present and involved in and watch the legislative process. And I was just thinking, if you would, this room accommodates approximately 200. Across the hall, that accommodates approximately 200. When we have committees that have 200 plus in this room, 200 in that room, and then a meeting that's going to two additional committee meetings that are going to meet within 15, 20 minutes. We probably have a couple hundred more people waiting out in the halls, and it's just not a safe environment. This isn't the accommodations that we want for the public that comes and participates and observes the legislative process. I've heard loud and clear from members and staff that work in these rooms the challenges and the vulnerabilities they feel sitting in this location when the rooms are so crowded here, the inability to get out. And part of it is a safety and security concern, and part of it is what do you do when you're sitting in a long meeting and you need to step out to meet with someone? You need to step out to use the restroom, perhaps, or you need to go to another meeting and come back to this. I know there are times where you're on two committees at one time, and it's difficult to navigate your way through the crowds of people. So we have some challenges with regards to safety, and I hate to use the word convenience because it just seems like it's trite, but it is the convenience of getting out and getting back in the rooms. So what we've done, though, to accommodate the public's need to be present is we have tried to have overflow rooms available. We have limitations in this building. When all the rooms are filled either with committees or are being used by different types of special interest groups, which is common during the legislative sessions, our 300, 400, and 500 north and south rooms are often used by groups in addition to all the rooms downstairs. Well, what do we do when we have a need for overflow? One of the things that we have done is set up 181, which has been the designated press conference room, and we use that for overflow. We'll set a TV up and direct people to go to that location. And we've basically lost 181 as not only a press conference room, but also an overflow room because of the need of the Public Information Department for broadcasting. That's now become a control room for the broadcasting, the channels. So this is another example where we've had additional needs and responsibilities of the House, but we lack the space to accommodate those needs. Another area that we've tried to provide access for the members of the public to come and watch the occurrences in committee hearings is we set up TVs. We place them on the walls on each floor on the north side so that people can watch what's going on in the committee rooms. The downside of that is we've taken away space that was used as a waiting area for the public that wants to see their members, and it's also very disruptive for the people that work on either side of these locations. So we're kind of stuffing people in corners, trying to give them accommodations so that they can see what's occurring, but we're also causing issues and challenges for other people by displacing them. We're making spaces for people to work for in areas that aren't designed for human occupancy. This picture here is right outside of our Director of Public Information, Barry LaGrave's office. You can see the green wall that's there, and they use that for their broadcasting. That's also become a television production area as we've increased the number of channels that we're broadcasting on. This is our engineering director. He's taking care of very sensitive information data. There was no other place for him, so he's basically been placed in the hall, and we've created a desk there. This picture makes it look like it's a nice, big, vast area, but it's actually quite crowded. There aren't environmental controls for him. It's on the south side. In the summer when we have the sun shining in, it exceeds the temperature that would be acceptable, and the environmental controls don't exist there. Our controller's office in the basement, the ground level, this I don't believe was designed for human occupancy. The controls in this, you could nearly make ice cubes in the winter when we have these cold days near the ground level here. Can't tell if it's daylight or nighttime sitting in that room, and the window looks out into an area that looks like it's more of a cell in a gulag or something. And we have people, a director's office in the basement of the in the subground level. We have a variety of life safety challenges and exiting here. The internal stairwells are open into unprotected, non-fire rated areas of the building and don't meet the code's requirements for emergency egress. If this building was built today, this wouldn't be allowed or permissible. Some designated areas of refuge are within internal stairways, thus requiring leaving the fire rated area to exit the building. You know, this reminds me of an incident we had a couple years ago. It's come to be known as the burrito incident, where we had a burrito that on an upper floor that was burnt, and it activated the fire alarm, so everyone had to evacuate the building. And it just happened to be a day where we had a disability day on the Hill, and we had people in wheelchairs and scooters throughout the building meeting with members in committee hearing rooms, and it was really an eye-opener for us. There was a lot of beyond panic, there were people that were extremely concerned because you could smell the smoke throughout the building, and everyone thought this is perhaps this is the real thing, and they had an inability to exit the building. We had people that were helping people, literally carrying them down the stairs, trying to get them out of the building, and we had other people that were in offices and just didn't know what to do. My phone and the others throughout the building that are involved in emergency response lit up that day, and it was a good eye-opening experience. As things turned out, it was just a burrito that burnt. We're lucky. And we were lucky that no one got hurt trying to take the stairs that shouldn't have been taking the stairs. And one of the things we did, though, on that day is we got together with the St. Paul Fire Department and we identified areas of refuge. And these areas of refuge are places that we direct people to go to in the event of a fire. And there is a two-hour window period where they theoretically are going to be safe in that area. And then theoretically, the fire department, in the event of a fire, would come and rescue those people from that area. However, we don't have the communication systems in those areas to alert. There are many areas of refuge throughout this building and stairwells in the areas around the elevator, the main elevator banks, and elsewhere. We don't have an emergency power system beyond mere life safety to keep this building running. Most recently, we did replace the generator in this building, and when we have power blips in the system, that kicks on. However, that is just for the mere life safety, and if we have a power shutdown because the power grid goes down or some other area, we're not going to be able to continue to conduct business in the building. We'll be able to get in and out and exist in here, but not to be able to conduct business. And as I stated before, the entire building is a single smoke zone. There's poor evacuation or isolation of smoke or other contaminants that are in the air. Modern structures don't have that. We're able to zone in modern structures the air filtration systems throughout the building. Security is kind of a difficult thing to talk about in a public setting. But I have come to appreciate this fact about the state office building. The design and infrastructure of the building envelope, assembly areas, workspaces, and offices is poorly equipped to address the modern security concerns of workplace and public environments. I would ask that Captain Eric Roski of the Minnesota State Patrol comes and gives a perspective regarding security matters. Captain Roski has the vast responsibility here on the Capitol complex. He has a position that I held for some time. He's been in this role longer than I have, and he's experienced some challenges that I didn't have to deal with. With that, I would ask that Captain Roski.
Captain Roski, if you could please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Winkler and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. My name is Eric Roski. I am a captain with the Minnesota State Patrol and director of the Capitol Security Division.
Please proceed.
Thank you. In my 27 years in law enforcement, 23 have been spent as a Minnesota State Trooper, the last eight as director of Capitol Security. So I'll be entering my ninth session as a director in 2023. Prior to that, I was at the Capitol Complex on numerous deployments through my career as a state trooper for any number of events that occurred in recent decades. When I was appointed to this position, I came from our primary responsibility as an agency for traffic safety to our other statutory responsibility as the providers of security at the Capitol Complex. After a couple years here, I recognized the need to further my knowledge in that environment, in that area. And so I went back to school at the University of Minnesota and enrolled in a master's degree program there through the College of Science and Engineering called Master of Science in Security Technologies. What that program is designed is to train leaders to keep our communities safe in all 16 sectors of critical infrastructure as identified by the federal government, including cyber, physical, and virtual security systems. As you know, government is one of the sectors of critical infrastructure in the United States. Just as it is defined as systems and assets so vital to the United States that the incapacity or destruction of such systems and assets would have a debilitating impact on security, national economic security, national public health or safety, or any combination of those matters. As such, Capital Security Division, as defined in State Statute 299E, is responsible for security and public information services in state-owned buildings in the Capital area and to ensure the orderly conduct of state business and the convenience of the public. The mission statement of the Capital Security Division is to provide safety and security for all activities that occur in the Capital Complex through service, assistance, education, and enforcement. So while I'm not going to speak directly to physical security vulnerabilities in this building, specific details of those, I will say that we approach, and I approach all physical and security issues that come to our attention in the same way as far as using a risk management approach to those. When it comes to physical security in this building or others, we combine people, our staff, state employees, people who come here, policy, how we do our jobs, and equipment or the physical security infrastructure in place to ensure a safe environment for employees, for the public who come here to voice their concerns or satisfy their needs, and also the elected officials that need to do their job in a safe environment. That being said, what I would say about the current status of the state office building, and Director Given and Mr. Meyerson pointed this out in many different facets, is due to the age and construction and physical layout of the building, as contrasted to more recently constructed buildings, there are more challenges at the state office building, balancing the need for public access and the need to provide a safe working environment for visitors, elected officials, and employees. I know that we have had physical security assessments done of this building. Those have pointed out the things that need to be addressed. And I think that this particular situation that we have provides us an opportunity to address some of those things. As I mentioned, I'm not going to discuss specific vulnerabilities, but I can tell you, and as you all, as folks who work here and are here regularly, recognize the contrast between this building, some of the other buildings that have been constructed in recent years, and the state capitol, which was renovated or restored in recent times as well. So I have no additional information or specifics I will share other than the fact that we recognize there are a number, besides the accessibility issues, the structural issues of the building, there also are security vulnerabilities that we think could be addressed through a restoration or remodeling of this building. Thank you.
Thank you, Captain Roski. Mr. Meyerson, I think you're ready to conclude or wrap up, and then we'll go to member comments and questions for the testifiers.
Chair Winkler, members of the committee, thank you. And I thank you, Captain Roski, for being present today. I know it's kind of a challenge to be able to talk about security matters without talking about security matters, but I think we all recognize some of the challenges that we have here with regards to security. The threat climate has changed. Security matters and the threats ebb and flow through time, and I feel like we've been in a constant state of flow that we're experiencing unprecedented times throughout the country as well as here in the state of Minnesota. I know that Captain Roski has experienced things that he probably didn't dream of, and I know that we have in the state office building been dealing with things. I never in my wildest imagination would have said it was necessary to do what happened a couple years ago with constructing a fence around the Capitol, because there were people that had intentions of doing things here on the Capitol complex and at the Capitol. I think that we've been lucky. As I've stated before, in many ways, shapes, or forms, we've been lucky that things haven't happened. And there's a saying about, in risk management, that which is predictable is preventable. I think about the things that we saw today, they were predictable and they were preventable. A lot of what we've seen today and heard is kind of disturbing, it's shocking, and it's really unacceptable. We know, though, that things are going to happen. Mr. Given talked about we're going to have some water intrusion, we're going to have some failures, and we just hope that they're not more severe and more impactful for the people that work here and for the process and aren't more destructive to the building. And we hope that when things happen, people aren't injured to the extent they're greater than they were. But I think hope isn't a plan to work on. We've relied on luck, and relying on luck is not a good risk management strategy. This building has insurmountable challenges for us. We know this is an old building, and the building is used today for different purposes than it was when it was originally constructed. It's being used today in a different way than it was used when it was renovated in 1984. And this year and going forward, we can expect to have more people in this building, and we can expect this building to continue to deteriorate. And we need to do something substantial, significant to this building in order to not be relying on luck. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Meyerson. Members, before we adjourn, I'll discuss a little bit about plans for Wednesday, but I thought we would have a little bit of time for discussion, whether questions or comments from members for the testifiers you've heard from today. Representative New Brindley. You need a new plaque.
I do need a new plaque. Thank you. Yeah, that changed during the pandemic. We didn't need them then. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifiers. This was really helpful hearing from each of the testifiers. If it's okay, Mr. Chair, I do have questions for a couple of different testifiers. Number one, I'm wondering if I have a question for Mr. Fenley. Mr. Chair. Mr. Fenley, I very much appreciate the presentation you gave. As somebody who cared for a family member in a very large wheelchair, I recognize that even that elevator is not adequate for all circumstances. My question, however, is as the building sits now, is it ADA compliant, or are there public access areas that are not ADA compliant?
Mr. Fenley.
So, caveat being, the determination, Chair Winkler, committee member, no. In short, no. Yeah. I mean, I could go through like little aspects here and there. Really, the only thing that can determine that in the end is, you know, an accessibility audit and or a subsequent, you know, enforcement action from either the Department of Human Rights, the Department of Justice, or a ruling by a judge. But based on just the outside entrances, based on the slopes, based on the widths of aisles, it's not code compliant. It's not ADA compliant. The ADA and building code operate a little bit differently, kind of in tandem with each other, and I'm happy to describe the difference between the two. It can get a little weedy. If you want, I can do that. But in short, no.
Representative New Brindley.
So just to be clear, I don't remember how I phrased the question. Are you saying the building is not ADA compliant?
There are access issues. There are, yeah. Anytime. So a good example would be the one accessible entrance that you have. If that drop-off zone is blocked, if that accessible entrance is not accessible to someone, that is an example of an instance of a barrier. And if somebody couldn't get in the building, they could sue you.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was noticing that. Is the entrance on opposite the one that is shown in the picture? Does that one have thresholds, or what makes that one non-ADA compliant?
It's
Mr. Fenley or Mr. Meyerson.
We have Chair Winkler, Representative. We have one designated ADA access, and it's on the south side. The north side is not open to the public because of some of the activities that we have, and also there's not a public drop-off nearby. So our turnaround on the south side dictates that that's where our ADA drop-off and pickup and access is located.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so the entrance on the other side could be ADA compliant if we if we chose to do that. I mean, there's no physical barriers on the other side.
Mr. Meyerson?
Chair Winkler, Representative, the thing that precludes that from being the drop-off, although the door would serve, it has the hardware in the door openers on there. We don't have a drop-off location in close proximity to that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Newbrinley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a couple of questions for Mr. Given. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Given, I'm wondering, you said that you reevaluate the building space every 3 years.
Yes, ma'am.
And so I'm wondering, there are a number of items that are listed in poor condition, a number of items that are listed in fair condition. I am wondering, that's clearly been almost 3 years now that they have been listed in those conditions. Prior to this most recent one, almost 3 years ago, this most recent evaluation, what was the change? Did these items move from fair to poor? Had they already been poor? Did they move from good to fair? What's the history a little bit?
Mr. Given. We're all a little rusty with in-person committee hearings, so.
So am I.
Yeah.
We've seen it's a continual degradation. Back in 2010, the condition was rated in a fair condition as well. I mean, it just now it's almost into the poor, and that's when we started the pre-design for the renovation back then. So, you know, some of the conditions, the ones that are in excellent, like the floors, they continue to be in excellent. That's terrazzo floor. That's going to last 100 years, and it was probably that way back then. But the HVAC system, you know, the floods that Mr. Meyerson was talking about occurred back in 16 before this, and they were already rated it poor. So it's kind of a mix, but it's a general, as we see with all buildings, a general progression of deterioration. It's just the way that they deteriorate. The rating was poor, however, before that. And, fair. The rating was fair. It's still fair, but now it's in the low fair.
We have a D-. Representative Newbrinley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Given. Can you explain to us a little bit how this works? You've got the condition of the entire building at fair, but obviously lots of individual elements are not. Is there a reason? I mean, I texted Representative Nash. He and I serve on the state government committee together. I asked Leader Dowd. He was Speaker of the House for 4 years during this time. And we've never seen requests to repair these items over these, certainly since I've been here and since I've sat on the committee. We've never had an appropriation request to fix the roof that is in poor condition. We've never seen an appropriation request to fix some of these things that we've known are a problem, and surely the roof could be repaired. One, why is that? And why do we not manage these things individually? And I understand that there are issues. Some things need to be dealt with in totality. I get that. But some things certainly do not. Some things certainly can be dealt with. So why is that? And how do these ratings, both as a whole, the building being fair, and the condition of these individual systems, how does that compare to other buildings on the Capitol complex? I know that you gave a comparison to the Senate office building, but frankly, that's probably not a very useful comparison. That's almost a brand new building. We would expect that building to have very few problems and issues at this point. So how does this compare to other buildings on the Capitol complex?
Mr. Given.
Okay, I'll break this down into several parts. So first of all, with regards to the compartmentalization of the deficiencies, there are a lot of things that we do take care of, depending on what the cost is of those particular elements and how disruptive they are to the occupants. For instance, the HVAC system. To completely redo that, you would have to certainly probably evacuate or
move some people out of the building. It would be very disruptive. So over the years, we have done some major repairs to the building. We did have a major roof repair project that was out for bid, $600,000. But we held off on it because the restoration was getting traction. We have, you know, a lot of other competing elements on the Capitol complex. I will say from a facilities management standpoint, the state office building and the overall ranking of buildings on the Capitol complex has been our number one priority in facilities management since 2010. Because it's it just because of the condition and rating, because of the time we spend on the building. So we have taken care of a lot of things to keep them in the condition that they're in when we could. You know, I can't answer the question why, you know, you haven't seen a bonding request. However, we have spent significant amounts of money that we have on the building to keep things from completely falling apart. And that's what we've done. So, you know, we've done a wholesale replacement of the control system for the fire alarm panel. You know, we are replacing the roof on the ramp. We were set to replace the roof and the leaders on this building. But we've also been hedging it against, oh, we're going to get a restoration project. So you kind of, you don't want to throw a lot of money into a building if you think it's going to be renovated. We just spent millions of dollars on carpet and tile in this building. So we do take care of those things within our means. But as the building gets older, just like the body that Mr. Fenley talked about, it breaks down. And it's getting to the point where, you know what, we can't keep up with it anymore.
And I think for the record, it's important to note that bonding requests have been submitted by the Department of Administration in the governor's bonding budgets for many of these repairs. And Mr. Wazlowski from the Department of Administration, I don't know if you want to touch on that. Your presence at the front row indicates you might want to have a comment or two. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, I'm Wayne Wazlowski. I'm the interim assistant commissioner over facilities and enterprise services. And I would just say we've had been carrying this building on our bonding requests since at least 2013, 2014 timeframe. And I would give an example of, and I would just say, I think every time we talked about capital restoration, both in committee hearings and in directly with members, the need to renovate the state office building came up as a conversation point. So I think this clearly has been an ongoing conversation that has been out there on the need to address this, and not just in a peaceful manner. So I would give the roof example as one. Why'd you hold off on the roof while you're thinking about other things? One is that Mr. Meyerson mentioned the air intakes. Right now they're at ground level, and potentially you're going to want to put those up on the roof. So if you redo the roof before you deal with the air handling systems, you could have to rework that. So we're just get to a point where you're beyond the ability to do this in a piecemeal manner, and you need to do it in a comprehensive fashion, or else you're going to be redoing work as you go along. So I'm happy to answer any other questions regarding that.
Representative Brindley, one more, and then we'll go to Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I apologize, I forget your name already.
Yeah,
if I don't write it down, yeah. I forget it immediately. I apologize. Yeah. But thank you for that. Yeah. I've been very involved in bonding the last 4 years, and I have not seen those requests. So I don't know where they got lost in translation, but they have not ended up in bonding spreadsheets at the end of session, which usually includes most of the projects. So that's a little bit frustrating, and I apologize for that. I guess, Mr. Chair, I would just ask, and I don't know if you're going to go over this today or if this will not happen until Wednesday. I assume at some point we will actually see some numbers of what we're thinking about. It's frustrating for me as a member of this committee for many years now, and also, like I said, a member of the State Government Committee for many years now, that we have not had these discussions until now, where this building is now rated close to poor. It's a very low fare, and part of the reason for that, obviously, is that a number of systems have been allowed to reach a poor rating over the years because we have not maintained them as we perhaps could have. And I don't know where that breakdown is. I don't know why those decisions were made over time. Again, I asked Representative Dowd when he was Speaker if those ever elevated to him. They had not. I checked in with Representative Nash. Neither of us ever remember these requests or these discussions coming before the State Government Committee, which would have been an appropriate place to talk about them and deal with them. It's frustrating that we are now sitting here today, and we don't know the numbers. We've heard rumored numbers that could be more than the state capitol renovation. We don't know what those are yet. And so while I very much appreciate the discussion from the testifiers, and certainly we are all aware of problems and flaws with the building, this approach is very frustrating, that now we are going to be asked, rather than dealing with many of these issues in a way that could have been dealt with over time, we are now being asked to put the taxpayers on the hook for a major renovation, again, perhaps more than the cost of the entire renovation of the State Capitol building, when we could have been dealing with these things over time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a quick question for you before I'll go into the other ones. If I remember correctly, I think it was in the 2020 legislative session, and it all runs together given the pandemic, but there was a bill that was passed in the state government finance, or there's a provision passed in state government finance that appropriated hundreds of millions of dollars to renovate this building, and I believe it became law, and perhaps somebody from the revisor's office or your staff could check the veracity of that, but I'm pretty sure that happened. I remember speaking eloquently against it, but is that going to be the funding source for this, or could you maybe help us out on that?
Well, thank you, Representative Nash. So I'll just address process and kind of what I see going ahead, and we're past time for today, but we'll continue that conversation. So first of all, yes, in the 2021 state government finance bill, there was a provision included that would allow the Department of Administration to develop a plan for a building renovation, which would include the state office building. That was passed through the House. I believe Representative Dowd spoke in favor of that on the floor. There was a voice vote to put that on the bill. It was negotiated with Senator Gazelka and with Senator Rosen to make sure that we were doing this in a way that would address the needs of the state office building. And it was passed by the House and Senate and signed into law. So that provision is 16B.2406, and that is a provision that would allow a renovation project to move forward. It does require approval of the building's major tenant, which is the House of Representatives. And what we're going to do on Wednesday is hear a process. A design and consulting team was selected by the Department of Administration to engage with stakeholders and tenant groups within the state office building and to develop a set of needs based on current use, included safety, security, infrastructure, all the concerns that we're hearing today. And we will look at options for addressing the problems that we are seeing today in this building and what we could do about it in the future. And we will be reviewing all of that on Wednesday.
And
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's almost as if you were anticipating that question to come up, having that statute right in front of you. That's good.
I wrote it, Representative Nash.
I know.
Near and dear.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, I guess one of the things I would ask either Mr. Meyerson or Captain Roski if I could. Mr. Chair, you and I serve on the Capital Area Security Commission together, and we've done a lot of good bipartisan work there. One of the concerns that I have principally about an overhaul of this building or whatever building that we may occupy is it's a delicate balance between the accessibility for the public and for those that make their living here, and I see some lobbyists that are in the crowd, and the safety of those who inhabit this building on a daily basis. And that's a very important thing. And I just want to make sure that we put that out there as a precursor to any conversation that we're going to be having, that that's, in my estimation, perhaps more important than a lot of other things, is we work for the people of Minnesota, and we can't say gosh, folks, for the safety of all the people who work here, we don't want you to come down. And I think that there's a very delicate balance that we have to achieve in making people feel as if they're not welcomed here, because I think they are. But we have to make sure that we're doing it in such a way that it is accessible for people who have needs to access the building differently than people who are not handicapped. But we have to do it also in a way that says to people, we want you here because we want to hear from you. And I just want to make sure that that's a component that we're putting forward before we come back on Wednesday. Because if that were not to be the case, I think that you'd see a lot of people fighting this effort, because that's just an unacceptable process. So if we could ask the testifiers.
Looks like Mr. Meyerson's ready to
thank you, Mr.
address
Chair.
Your question. Go ahead.
Chair Winkler, Representative Nash, and other members, I appreciate that. And we've been dealing with that conflicting mandates since the first time I started working for Capital Security. We have a mandate to make sure that the building and the process of government is open, not just in perception, but in reality. We want it open and welcoming for people to come, but we also want it to be safe and secure. We owe it to the people that come here, the public. And it's difficult at times, and it's constantly in the front of our mind, in the front of the discussions, to make sure that it's reality, that it's open. And every decision we make is made with those two thoughts in mind, that it's open and accessible, but yet it's safe and secure for the people that come here, and that the infrastructure actually accommodates the needs so that we can keep people safe.
And Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And lastly, and I'll be very brief, I would hope that if we do some sort of modernization that as an IT person we would not have the revisor's data only stored in a data center in one place, that we would practice best practices and back it up to the cloud perhaps.
Representative Nash, that's a great aspiration. The audiovisual system that we're using right now, they used to go to Axeman for parts to replace failing components, but Axeman is out of that business too. So it's not just the IT and data systems that are woefully out of date. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to start just by thanking the testifiers, and not just for what you've presented this morning, but also for the ongoing work that you've done to get us to this point, and to communicate to everybody what the needs are, and then also have done that objective research about where this building stands. And to go back to where Mr. Meyerson started, that what we're talking about is an inadequate building that we work in right now, the state office building, and that it's inadequate because of the infrastructure, the security, and the functionality. But I have to say, functionality, I don't think really embraces all of what we're talking about, which is the purpose of why we have this building. And to pick up on what Representative Nash said too, is that the public belongs here, and we should also be able to do our work. And it's not just the members, but it's all of the staff and the public together. So it's our purpose of coming together to be a legislative body, and we know that right now we're at a critical point and a critical juncture, and that we cannot let this opportunity go by without taking the steps needed to fulfill the purpose of our body and the other offices that work here. So thank you for all of the work and for being available for the questions that we've had and your continued involvement in this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. I think I'll just conclude by saying that it's, I think, very difficult to listen to this presentation and see the information presented to the committee and to the public today and not conclude that we are at a end of life for the state office building as it is today. We could shut down the building and continue to try to operate internally using the functional spaces as best we can in a way that we did in the last part of the last legislative session. We could adopt a more virtual style of conducting our business in the state house like we did during the pandemic. We could open it up and hope for the best and continue on the plan that we've been on. or we could make some significant changes to this building and make it accessible and secure and safe and functional for years to come. And those choices are in front of us. I am going to, on Wednesday, be leading a conversation about what work done to the building could look like and what it might cost and how a process was developed to assess that. But ultimately, it is the decision of the legislature as a whole, or this House, I should say, to decide which of those four options will work best for the future of the state. And with that, we are adjourned.